argument this morning is Pease against Production Workers Local 707. Ms. Coolidge.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Alexia Kulwick, and I represent the plaintiff appellants in this matter, Mr. Christopher Pease, Mr. Willard or Bill Berge, Mr. Michael Gear, and Mr. Vince Vitti. Among other things, Your Honors, this case is about the decision by the district court when it rejected a jury verdict, usurping the jury's role in interpreting 3 days of trial testimony. Your Honors, the most pertinent facts before you are simply that these four employees previously worked at Defendant Randall. Defendant Randall had a labor agreement with Defendant Production Workers Union of Chicago and Vicinity, Local 707. Despite the fact that Randall and Local 707 had a labor agreement, these four employees supported a change in union representation. Both Randall and Local 707 knew that the four employees before you rather supported the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. These four employees had several grievances against Randall for violation of its labor agreement. Most pertinent before you today is concerning their layoff or termination from Randall. They filed grievances which were denied, and Local 707 failed to represent them. Turning first to the district court's decision to grant defendants' motion for judgment as a matter of law. As the Supreme Court stated in Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing, and this court has stated in numerous cases, including Tart versus Illinois Power Company and Emo versus Coca-Cola Bottling Company, in looking at a motion for judgment as a matter of law, the district court must not weigh evidence. It must make any reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party, and it must not make any credibility determinations. Rather, as the Supreme Court instructed in Reeves, the district court must disregard evidence favorable to a moving party that the jury is not required to believe. Mr. Berge's claim against Defendant Randall was that it violated the seniority provisions of its labor agreement with Local 707 when it laid off or terminated Mr. Berge instead of an employee who no longer had job classification seniority as a truck driver, Mr. Roy Walker. The district court, however, credited the testimony of Randall officer Chuck Truckenbrout, finding that Chuck Truckenbrout's testimony somehow was evidence of an agreement between Defendant Randall and Defendant Local 707. There are numerous problems with the district court's analysis on this point. First, Randall waived its ability to argue that there
Counsel,
was...
I don't understand how we even get to where you are. The first step in all of these hybrid actions is a demonstration that the union violated its duty of fair representation. And as I understand what was going on, there were two workers, both of whom it represented, Burge and Walker. Walker had the most seniority, we agree, if he had not forfeited it in some way. And the union concluded that Walker had better claim and allowed him to bump Burge. Now, why did that violate the duty of fair representation? It looked like the union had two workers with competing claims. It could only favor one. And surely you're not taking the position that when there are competing claims, whichever one loses can sue. It must have violated the duty of fair representation. And why was this a violation of the duty of fair representation?
Several things in response to you, Your Honor. The first is that The evidence demonstrated, there's plenty of evidence in the record to support the jury's inference that the reason that 707 failed to represent Mr. Berge is because he supported Local 150 against Local 707. But backing up a moment regarding facts that Your Honor has suggested in terms of why we're here before you today, taking as we must the evidence in favor of Mr. Berge on a motion for judgment of as a matter of law, the facts demonstrate that at the time Berge was laid off or terminated, Mr. Roy Walker was not, in fact, a union member, Your Honor. Mr. Berge's testimony was that
you don't have to be a union member. In fact, it's an essential rule of labor law that the duty of fair representation is owed to everybody in the bargaining unit, whether he is a member of the union or not.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And also at the time...
So your argument is irrelevant. What relevant argument do you have?
Okay, Your Honor. Both, also under federal labor law, you're right. A union must provide fair representation to an individual in the bargaining unit. Both Chuck Truckenbrout and Randall Truckenbrout, the company's witnesses, acknowledged that at the time they let Mr. Berge go, Mr. Roy Walker was not, in fact, working in the bargaining unit. So he was neither a union member, nor was he, in fact, a member of the bargaining unit at the time the company made the decision to lay off or terminate Mr. Berge. Bad faith, among other things, Your Honors, forbids a union from failing to represent a union member if he does not support the union, or for failing to represent that member because his views towards the union leadership, for example. What this court requires in determining whether or not bad faith has occurred is whether or not there is evidence sufficient for the jury to infer that the union failed to represent that individual based on bad faith. And the facts here, in fact, presented the jury with sufficient evidence to find or to infer that Local 707 failed to represent Mr. Berge because he supported Local 150 and not Local 707. Those facts include such things as the fact that Mr. Berge did, in fact, support Local 150. Craig Thornton, the business agent for Local 707, acknowledged that he knew that Mr. Berge, in fact, supported Local 150 and their campaign to organize those employees. When Local 707 made the decision not to move forward with Mr. Berge's claims, no one from 707 told Mr. Berge why not. But at trial, business agent Craig Thornton testified that the reason he didn't think the claim had merit was that he engaged in surveillance and there was only one person driving a truck at the Portage facility. But Randall Truckenbrout and Mr. Lauren Pease contradicted that at trial at all times, or almost all times, with the exception perhaps, depending on whose testimony you believe, 1 or 2 weeks, there were two drivers at that facility. When Mr. Berge saw Mr. Craig Thornton from 707 at the election between Local 150 and Local 707, Mr. Berge approached 707 representative Craig Thornton. The only thing Mr. Thornton said to Mr. Berge was, "What can I do for you, Mr. 150? There was sufficient facts here, Your Honors, from which the jury could infer that the reason 707 failed to represent Mr. Berge was that it was acting, in fact, in bad faith. Your Honor,
what was the timing on Walker coming off of the non-bargaining unit job back to being a driver vis-a-vis Berge being laid off?
Your Honor, Berge was laid off, as everyone agrees, May 15, 2002. Chuck Truckenbrout testified that it was almost immediately that Mr. Walker was put back in the role of truck driver from his job as rental coordinator. Mr. Randy Truckenbrout and Mr. Lauren Pease testified that it was approximately 2 weeks from the time period that Mr. Berge was laid off and the company moved Mr. Walker into that position of truck driver.
Now, instead of saying that you're getting laid off because we don't have enough work, would it have been okay if they said you're getting laid off because Walker's coming back and he's bumping you?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is that there's nothing in the collective bargaining agreement or the labor agreement between these parties that provides anybody with any sort of bumping rights. And what Mr. Berge's claim is premised on, and the evidence was sufficient for the jury to find, was that in fact when Mr. Walker transferred out of a job as truck driver, into the job as rental coordinator, he did not retain any seniority rights. So because there was indeed sufficient evidence for the jury to find that, there was no reason for Randall, under the collective bargaining agreement, to terminate or lay off Mr. Berge. In fact, that's one of his points before the jury, Your Honor, is that Randall did not, in fact, lay Mr. Berge off because the company was in some sort of serious downturn. Rather, Chuck Truckenbrough testified that he knew he needed two truck drivers at the Portage facility. At the time the company decided to lay off Mr. Berge, there were two drivers, Mr. Michael Gere and Mr. Bo Berge. There was no reason to even use the collective bargaining agreement to terminate or lay off one of the individuals. What the company did, in essence, and what the jury could have believed, is that it was eliminating the position of rental coordinator. They were restructuring their business. They decided they no longer needed a rental coordinator. What the company should have done is, therefore, eliminated the individual in the job position that they were eliminating, which was not, in fact, a bargaining unit position.
What about the side agreement that was outside the contract?
Several responses to Randall's argument that there was some sort of side agreement, Your Honor. First, and I think most importantly, the district court misinterpreted this court's holding in this Trailer versus Brown case to find that he had to believe Chuck Truckenbrough's testimony that there was, in fact, any kind of side agreement. This court in Trailer did not say that if the testimony was not directly or exactly contradicted, that the jury had to believe it. Rather, what this court has said in numerous cases, including Emil versus Coca-Cola, is that as long as the plaintiff can put forth some evidence to discredit the testimony relied on, the jury is in fact entitled to believe that testimony. And I'm quoting from Emil versus Coca-Cola when this court said, defendants are off base in arguing that just because the testimony of their officers was not contradicted directly, the jury had to accept it. That was the case in this case, Your Honor. Mr. Chuck Truckenbrough testified as to a conversation with Edgar Roman. But there was sufficient evidence presented to call that testimony into question. The labor agreement itself, which is Plaintiff and Defendant's Exhibit 1, does not speak to the retention of job seniority. Mr. Randy Truckenbrough testified that there is no contract language that speaks to the retention of seniority when a member moves out of the bargaining unit. Local 707 trustee Sue Schreiner likewise testified that based on her knowledge of the labor agreement between Randall and Local 707, there was no contract language that addressed the retention of seniority when an employee left the bargaining unit and took another position at the company. Local 707 representative Craig Thornton testified that it was this Sue Schreiner that made the decision not to go forward with Berge's grievance and take it to arbitration. The person who made the decision not to take his case to arbitration is the person that at trial testified that she's not familiar with any retention of seniority in the labor agreement that would allow someone to move out of the bargaining unit and keep their seniority. Your Honors, in addition to this conflicting evidence, however, the testimony relied on by the district court to find that side agreement is not even at all clear. Starting on page 635 of the transcript, Your Honors, in response to leading questions by Local 707 counsel, Mr. Chuck Truckenbrough testified that it is Randall's policy that if an individual leaves the bargaining unit, they can retain your seniority. His term at that point in his testimony was not that there was a side agreement or an oral modification to the contract, but that it was the company's policy that the individual could, in fact, retain seniority. When questioned further about Local 707's position, Your Honors, Chuck Truckenbrough then testified that Edgar Roman told him, and I'll quote here from 635 and 636 of the transcript, that Edgar Roman said, quote, "We treat it as a layoff. You're away from your work for up to a year. You get to retain your dash as if it were a layoff. You're not available for work now, and you retain your seniority if you go back, just as if you were called back." That's it, Your Honors. That's the testimony that the district court found so compelling. Mr. Chuck Truckenbrough did not say there was an oral modification between these parties. He did not say there was any sort of oral contract between between these parties. In that conversation between Chuck Truckenbrout and Edgar Roman, he didn't even say that the parties agreed that the individual here, Mr. Roy Walker, retained his seniority when he moved from the bargaining unit into the position as rental coordinator.
Does the CBA say specifically that you retain your seniority for 1 year during layoff?
Yes, Your Honor. In Article 13 of the agreement, what it says is that you actually, the language is an employee loses seniority after 12 months of layoff. Your Honors, because Chuck Truckenbrout's testimony was not at all clear, and because there was, in fact, sufficient evidence to discredit that testimony based on the contract itself, the testimony of Randy Truckenbrout and Sue Schreiner, and indeed how the parties even treated Roy Walker during that time period, present enough conflicting testimony that the jury could have disbelieved Chuck Truckenbrout and not found any side agreement or oral modification to these parties' agreements. How the parties treated Chuck Truckenbrout in this time period, again, as Bergie said, Mr. Walker was not a union member at that time, and Mr. Truckenbrout stated that they did not deduct any union dues. Briefly, Your Honors, as we also raise in our brief, the court erred in excluding certain relevant testimony based on hearsay ground. Quickly, one conversation by operations manager, Mr. Gene Clark, in which he indicated what Mr. Randy Truckenbrout would do if the union came in, and that is to close their doors. Under Rule 801(b)(2) of the Federal Rules of Evidence, Mr. Gene Clark's statement is an admission by the party and, in fact, should have been admitted to the trial for the jury to hear. Likewise, under Rule 801(b)(2)(d) of the Federal Rules of Evidence, comments from this co-employee that Mr. Pease attempted to testify to in his testimony should have been admitted as he was speaking within the scope of his employment, and that would have made that testimony non-hearsay. Because Mr. Pease's claims required that he prove Randall's animus towards Local 150, these were extremely relevant statements, and the court erred in not admitting them for the jury to hear. They were non-hearsay statements under Rule 801(b)(2)(d) of the Federal Rules of Evidence. Your Honors, the district court also erred.
Any rebuttal time, I just thought I'd let you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. I also just want to quickly note that under Salgado versus CDW, the district court could have counted Mr. Vitti's time at a placement agency to find that he had claims at Randall as well. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. There's no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Dark.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Let me address in one sentence, I hope, the issue of the evidence not being admitted. Mr. Berge went to trial on a claim that he'd been discriminated against for support of Local 150. He lost that case, and he didn't appeal it. So there's no issue about the introduction of evidence being in error. That case is not before you. With respect to the claim that he does have before you, which is that there was a violation of the collective bargaining agreement, the issue for this court to decide is, what does the contract say, and what did Berge prove that it said? The contract is silent. Mr. Berge has a no evidence case. He is attempting to fill that gaping hole by saying, well, you could disbelieve Chuck Truckenbrout, and therefore, by disbelieving him, the jury could infer the opposite of his testimony was true. And in the line of cases that Ms. Kowicki has cited to you, the court has specifically said, and there are a number of cases going beyond what she cited, say that that is not permissible. What evidence was there with respect to this issue? Did Walker lose his seniority as a driver when he transferred out of the unit? The contract was silent. The contract did have a provision that said when you were hired into a bargaining unit position, your date of seniority dated with your date of hire. Walker, it is conceded, was hired in more than a year earlier. The contract also had a provision that said that after you'd been laid off for more than 12 months, you lost your seniority. The irony of this case, hopefully not lost on the court, is that this was supposedly a case where Mr. Berge wanted to go to labor arbitration. How do labor arbitrators decide cases like this?
they decide that if the contract is silent, a transfer out of the bargaining unit means you retain your seniority. Now, how did Mr. Berge attempt to fill this gaping hole? He does so by claiming that he impeached Chuck Truckenbaum, but that legally is not sufficient to provide positive evidence which required to prove your case. And as a matter of fact, there was no impeachment. If you look at page 7 of his brief and also page 20 and 21, he lists a number of items which he claims are his impeaching. They fit into two general categories. One is that there was no corroborating testimony. In fact, Judge Holderman found there was corroborating testimony. And if you look at page, I believe it's 2 or 3 of his decision, he refers to the testimony of Carrie Orrick, who testified at page 647 of the transcript, that the situation was that when the situation was that if it did not work out for the company or he didn't like it, he could always go back to being a driver. Now, that testimony corroborates Chuck Truckenbrout's testimony that there was an agreement that he did talk to a union representative and make an arrangement with him prior to the transfer of Walker that his seniority would remain intact. Now, Randy Truckenbrout also testified about this. He said, we made a commitment at page 490 of the transcript. We made a commitment when we moved him up to another position that he had a free pass back to his original position. Again, reflecting a prior commitment. Now, the impeachment that supposedly occurs is, I would say, microscopic flyspecking that does not survive a closer analysis. Number one, there's an impeachment because Mr. Truckenbaum testified that there was a downturn in their business and that's why they had a layoff. And then he said, well, there was a side agreement. Well, one is why something happened. The other is who it happened to. Those aren't inconsistent. There's this contradiction about what day Berge was let go. There was an exhibit introduced at trial, Randall Exhibit Number 28, which contains a payroll analysis of the driver's time. This document has been misrepresented to the court. The payroll periods are two-week periods, not one-week periods. So when a driver works 50 hours during the payroll period, he's not working overtime. He's not even working part-time. He's not working full-time. He's working part-time, 25 hours a week. Of the three company witnesses who were called to testify, Randy Truckenbrout, Chuck Truckenbrout, and Gary Orrick about this, all three testified to the existence of this side agreement. Now, the second element of impeachment, if you will, are what I would describe as situational facts. He was transferred out of the bargaining unit. Yes, that is true. Walker was transferred out. That frames the issue. It doesn't answer the question, did he forfeit his seniority? There's also argument about, when he moved out of the bargaining unit position, became a rental coordinator, he didn't belong to a union anymore. That's true. That's what happens when you transfer out of the bargaining unit. Your obligation to pay dues ceases. It doesn't mean, though, that your right to your seniority is terminated. And that was the open question here. Remember, that's the burden of proof that Berge has. Did Walker lose his seniority when he transferred out? Now, this court has formulated this impeachment inquiry a couple of different ways, but I suggest, with all due respect to the court, that looking at the Supreme Court's decision in Chesapeake and Ohio, which has a string side of cases in which this formulation is discussed, including some older Seventh Circuit opinions in the string side. The rule is that the uncontradicted testimony is to be credited unless, and in Chesapeake and Ohio, they list 5 items which have to be shown before the testimony that's uncontradicted can be put to the jury for a test.
Unless what?
And those 5 items are, it's contradicted by direct evidence, not present here.
You mean unless these things occur?
Yes, sir.
One.
And they are found at page 218 of the Supreme Court's opinion there. None of these are present, and none of them have been argued. There's no direct evidence. There are no legitimate inferences from the evidence that was presented. It's not opposed to the probabilities. I mean, there's a gap in this labor contract. What did the Supreme Court say in the trilogy? That contracts can't cover everything, and that there develops a law of the shop that fills in these gaps. What was the testimony? The testimony was that there was a practice of allowing people to transfer into other jobs on a temporary basis or trial basis with the right to return. And indeed, one of the plaintiffs in this case was allowed to do that. So the court's decision with respect to Berge should be affirmed. Mr. Pease, there are three reasons why Mr. Pease's summary judgment should be upheld. First off, Mr. Pease is not the proper plaintiff, and I would submit the court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear his claim. He committed a fraud on the bankruptcy court when he did not list his lawsuit as one of the assets of his estate. The only proper party that could bring Mr. Pease's claim to this court is the trustee, Ms. Helms. Secondly, Mr. Pease attempted to commit a...
Has the trustee been notified of this?
Of the lawsuit? She was. Not by us, by plaintiff's counsel.
And what did the trustee do?
She did not intervene. It was represented in open court to Judge Holderman. I believe it is in the record that she responded by, and I hope I quote her correctly, "Call me when it's over," was the response to the notice. Mr. Pearson, who is here in court, was the one who had the conversation with her. So my statement here is hearsay. The second reason is he attempted to commit a fraud on the court in trial. When Mr. Pease's case went to arbitration, his attorney at the arbitration told him there was a big hole in this case. His hole was, when did he get his learner's permit to drive a truck? When he came to trial, he testified to a date 4 months later. He then testified that his learner's permit had been destroyed, that he had no further use of it, so he had destroyed it. The Secretary of State, however, maintains records, and the records showed that he lied under oath. Now, the jury properly discredited him, obviously, and he's not appealing that, but I would say that his claim before you should be barred for that reason. He attempted to commit a fraud on the court, and this court has traditionally found that you cannot pursue claims after that point. The third thing is, he never made the claim in the pleadings in the first place that he now argues the court should have let proceed. If you look at paragraph 18 of the complaint, amended complaint, I might point out, he only argues that Local 707 breached its duty to him by not filing these grievances. In fact, the grievances were filed, and two of them were granted. So for him to stand before you and say, "I want my grievances that have already been paid out to go before the judge and to go before the jury," I submit to you, is disingenuous. Mr. Vitti, the third plaintiff, he is the junior man. The company's policy under the labor contract is last in, first out. Regardless of how you resolve the issue of his probationary status, the fact remains he's the junior man, and he was properly laid off. The motion for summary judgment should be affirmed as well. I have nothing further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Cameron.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. Your Honor, I only have to add that the case doesn't really only turn on the existence or the validity of the oral agreement or modification of the collective bargaining agreement. It also turns on the evidence or lack of evidence of bad faith by the union in adopting the position that it did, that the bargaining unit or that the seniority provision still protected Mr. Walker. And it seems to me that appellants are still arguing discrimination or arbitrariness, not the existence of any evidence supporting bad faith. The jury rejected arbitrariness. They rejected the discrimination claim on the part of Mr. Berge. and they found bad faith. But I've yet to hear anything cited in the record that would tend to prove specific conduct on the part of Local 707 that would demonstrate bad faith. Bad faith has been defined as deceit, dishonesty, or fraud. Some vague references to one Local 707 representatives referring to Berge as that 150 guy is not enough to establish that there was fraud, deceit, or dishonesty on the part of Local 707. Without that, the claim for bad faith cannot stand. And although the union does not have the burden of proof on this matter, there was testimony in the union's case from Ms. Schreiner with respect to the union's position with regard to Walker's seniority. And although it's true that the collective bargaining agreement was silent as to this issue, there was no zipper clause, as Judge Holderman pointed out, and there was no integration clause. So the parties were, according to the decision in Mark, to orally modify the agreement. Even if they did not, it is in the union's interest, and the union represents the bargaining unit as a whole, not just Mr. Berge. It's in the union's interest, it's in the bargaining unit union's interest to have an expanded universe of employees protected by the seniority provision, for the obvious reason that, as Ms. Schreiner testified, that you don't want somebody getting promoted out and then losing their rights and getting fired. That lays it open to, I guess, a number of dirty tricks on the part of employers to get rid of bargaining unit members that it doesn't like by promoting them out and getting rid of them. They're protected by seniority. And even if this particular collective bargaining unit is silent, why wouldn't the union want to adopt the position that Walker's protected? It's the majority view by most arbitrators that an employee such as Walker would be protected. Even if not here, if Randall comes to the union and says, well, we're going to include Walker, we're going to say that he's protected, we're treating his promotion as a layoff, we know that the collective bargaining agreement is silent, and we're going to protect his seniority, why would the union then want to adopt the opposite position? There's been no expert testimony that's been introduced at trial that would contradict the union's position.
Well, I'm no expert, but if someone is promoted out, as you say, into management somewhere, either doesn't like it or doesn't perform or whatever, is it typical for them to be able to re-enter under this type of agreement and bump someone who is in good standing with the union and performing okay?
I would submit yes. And in fact, that's frequently a point of contention between members of management and labor unions. They want the seniority expanded. And it's true as...
Who does?
The union wants the...
So the union would condone, as a rule, this idea of somebody being promoted out where they're not no longer in the union, with perhaps no intent of coming back, except maybe it doesn't work out and the person wants to come back. Does this require a prior agreement, some prior arrangement, or is it typical to be able to re-enter without a penalty, in fact, retain your seniority when you didn't pay any dues?
Well, I would submit that I don't know if it's typical. I think with respect to most collective bargaining agreements, there probably is a provision that would cover this. In this particular one, there wasn't, and I... really not qualified to say whether or not it's typical. But I would submit that the union's position was certainly for the benefit of most of the bargaining unit members, because to allow an employee such as Walker to be promoted out and then lose his seniority is certainly not something that's going to protect the bargaining unit as a whole. And I don't really see that there's been any evidence to say that the union, in taking that position, has committed bad faith, that it's a fraudulent position, it's a dishonest position. It seems to me that it's in keeping with the policy of the union to protect its members. And it's not just one individual member. Sometimes members' interests conflict.
Was that the case with Pease? I believe it was. Was Pease the one that had the same position and then came back as a truck driver, or was it somebody else?
Your Honor.
Early on, before Berg.
Before Bergie?
Before Walker. Did Pease held this position and then came back as a truck driver? Do I remember that correctly, or maybe I don't?
To be honest, Your Honor, I'm not. I don't recollect. And therefore, I would say that Judge Holderman did not improperly weigh the evidence. There was no evidence to weigh. There was no evidence of deceit, dishonesty, or fraud. And without that, there's no liability on the part of Union, and therefore no liability on the part of Randall. And even after Ms. Schreiner's testimony, there was not any evidence, whether expert or otherwise, no testimony that would establish that the union's position was unreasonable. And I would submit that even if that testimony, that evidence did exist, and you could construe every inference in favor of the plaintiffs, that that evidence at best would only show arbitrariness, which the jury rejected. Bad faith requires some specific conduct, and there's nothing that was introduced at trial that would indicate that there was any dishonesty or fraud on the part of Local 707. And therefore, I submit, since the union's position was a reasonable one, and certainly was arguable without a specific provision within the collective bargaining agreement, that there can be no liability on the part of the union because there is no evidence of bad faith. With respect to the Vitti claim, again, that case wasn't taken in arbitration. It's clear he didn't have seniority. He wasn't he was a probationary employee and was not allowed to go through the grievance procedure. And there's nothing further on behalf of the union. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Colvin?
First of all, to answer Your Honor's question, I think you were referring to Plaintiff Christopher Pease, who was hired on initially as a salesman and then a rental coordinator. He was moved into the truck driver position after about 3 weeks, and he remained in that bargaining unit position until he was gone, which in fact demonstrates, Your Honor, that there is no past practice that these parties engaged in regarding what happened when an individual moved in and out of the bargaining unit, as has been suggested by Randall, at least in its brief. It's not here today.
Did he retain his seniority from original hire or when he was transferred in to be a truck driver?
Your Honor, the evidence at trial, and I believe it was Defendant's Exhibit 41, shows his seniority date, if you will, as hire date. But the document clearly demonstrates that the company chose to use hire date, but Randy Truckenbrout, company representative, testified and acknowledged that job classification seniority is what should matter in these decisions under the labor agreement. So it appears that the company used the hire date, even though everybody acknowledges and the contract provides that it's job classification seniority that should have been indicated in those records. Your Honors, the company in 707 has talked about the a practice or about the arbitration cases interpreting these kinds of seniority provisions. In fact, the cases submitted by the company regarding these seniority provisions all have different language than the contract here. They have language that set forth seniority throughout the course of employment. And the only case to talk about what the plurality or majority view of arbitrators is a case cited by Randall called Borg Warner, which states that there is no plurality or majority interpretation by arbitrators in these cases. So counsel is misspoken when he says that the majority of arbitrators would side with their position. I'd like to talk for a second about 707's position that there's no evidence of bad faith. Both the district court and 707 before this court have argued that what 707 did was reasonable. They believe Mr. Walker had seniority, so they let him stay at the company. But that's not what 707 said at trial. What they said is there's not two truck drivers, there's only one. That was contradicted at trial by the company, Randall Truckenbrout. Moreover, the evidence in the record, such as how Berge supported Local 150 and how 707 felt about it, provided the jury enough to infer that the reason 707 failed to help Mr. Berge was his support for Local 150. That evidence is sufficient in the record, not any evidence of a reasonable explanation. As to Randall's argument regarding its violation of the contract, Randall's counsel talks about what evidence impeached Mr. Charles Truckenbrout. Again, this court has made clear in a number of cases that as long as the plaintiff can submit sufficient evidence that the jury can rely on in disbelieving a witness, the jury is in fact entitled to disbelieve that witness. For these reasons, we request that the court reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.